Welcome to the deep dive, where we take a stack of sources and really try to pull out the key nuggets of knowledge for you.
That's the goal.
Today, we're diving into something truly fundamental, the incredible world of your muscular system. It's essential to, well, everything you do.
Absolutely.
We've got a great range of sources, you know, detailed anatomy, practical examples, and our mission really is to cut through that complexity.
Yeah, to make it accessible.
So you can quickly get up to speed on how your body moves, generates heat, and so much more.
And it's fascinating, isn't it, how something we do constantly just walking or picking up a cup relies on these incredibly intricate, specialized parts.
Totally.
We're going to try and peel back the layers today, you know, from the big muscles you can actually see down to the tiny molecular engines making it all happen.
So not just the what, but the why it matters.
Exactly. Why it matters for, you know, a simple walk or even a really tough workout.
Okay. So let's start broad, the big picture. When we say muscular system for this deep dive, what are we zeroing in on?
Good question. We're primarily focusing on skeletal muscles. So the muscles attached to your bones, the ones that let you move around.
Right. So we're kind of setting aside, for now, things like cardiac muscle, your heart, and smooth muscle, like in your organs. They're different beasts.
Entirely different. They have their own vital roles, absolutely. Yeah. But skeletal muscle is our focus today. And these skeletal muscles have basically three main jobs.
Okay, what are they?
First, mobility. That's, you know, moving your whole body through your environment. Walking, running, jumping.
Locomotion.
Precisely. Second, specific movement. Controlling parts of your body like waving your hand or typing or feeding yourself.
Fine motor control and bigger movements too.
Exactly. And third, something people don't always think about. Heat production. Thermogenesis.
Ah, yeah. Exercise makes you warm.
It sure does. Muscles are major heat generators. They're like little furnaces, metabolically speaking. We'll definitely dig into that more later.
Okay, so how is a muscle actually built? I've heard the analogy of, like, a rope.
That's a perfect analogy, actually. It really captures the structure. It starts with thousands of individual muscle cells. We also call them fibers.
Okay, fibers, tiny threads.
Very long, thin threads. And these fibers are bundled together. Imagine taking a bunch of threads and twisting them into a thicker strand. That bundle is called a fasciculus, or fasciculi for plural.
Fasciculus, got it.
Then you take multiple fasciculi, multiple bundles, and bundle those together. And that makes up the complete muscle that you'd recognize, like your bicep.
So layers upon layers of bundles.
Exactly. And each layer has its own wrapping of connective tissue. There's endomysium around each individual fiber.
Endo, meaning within.
Right. Then paramecium wraps around each fasciculus.
Peri, around.
Mm-hmm. And epimysium encapsulates the entire muscle. Epi, meaning upon or outer.
Okay, endo, peri, epi, wrappings for fiber, bundle, and whole muscle.
You got it. And then the whole thing, the entire muscle, is usually encased in another tougher layer called deep fascia.
Deep fascia. And that leads somewhere important, doesn't it? What about tendons?
Yes. The tendons are essentially a continuation of all that connective tissue, especially the deep fascia. They're made of dense, fibrous connective tissue, mostly collagen. Super strong stuff.
Collagen, right, like in ligaments too.
Very similar, yeah. Mm. And tendons are usually sort of roundish cords, and their main job is to anchor the muscle to bone. Sometimes muscle to muscle, but usually muscle to bone.
And these connections are seriously strong, right? I read something amazing that the bone might break before the tendon gives way.
It's absolutely true in some cases. Mm. The tendon fibers don't just attach to the bone surface. They actually merge with the outer covering of the bone, the periosteum.
Wow.
And some fibers, called Sharpey's fibers, penetrate right into the bone itself. It's an incredibly strong integration.
So if you have a bad injury.
Exactly. If there's a sudden, really forceful pull, the tendon can be so strong that instead of tearing, it actually pulls a piece of the bone right off. That's called an avulsion fracture.
Yikes. Okay. That really shows how tightly linked muscles and bones are.
Definitely. It underscores that they really function as one system, the musculoskeletal system.
Okay. Let's zoom way in now. Past the bundles, down to the individual muscle fiber, the cell. You said it specialized for one thing.
One primary thing, contraction, which just means it can shorten. That's its superpower. It pulls. It cannot push.
Only pulls. Got it. And inside that fiber.
Well, like any cell, it has a membrane here. It's called a sarcolemma, and cytoplasm called sarcoplasm. But the sarcoplasm is packed with stuff muscles need.
Like energy.
Exactly. stores of glycogen for fuel, and even myoglobin to hold on to oxygen. But the real action heroes inside are these bundles of tiny threads running the whole length of the fiber. They're called myofibrils.
Myofibrils. Okay, threads within the fiber, and there's something even smaller.
You bet. Inside the myofibrils are the myofilaments, and these are arranged in these incredibly organized repeating units called sarcomeres.
Sarcomeres, that sounds important.
They are the fundamental contractile units. Think of them as the tiny engines. Each sarcomere is where the shortening actually happens.
So what are these myofilaments made of?
There are two main types. You've got the thin myofilaments, primarily made of a protein called actin.
Actin, okay.
And the thick myofilaments, made mostly of myosin.
Actin and myosin, heard of those.
They're the key players. The sarcomere itself has boundaries, structures called Z-discs, and the actin filaments are anchored to these Z-discs. There's another protein, titin, which is kind of like a spring, anchoring the myosin to the Z-disc too. Keeps everything aligned.
Okay, so actin anchored at the ends, myosin in the middle. How do they make the sarcomere shorten? You mentioned the sliding filament mechanism.
Precisely. When a muscle gets the signal to contract, the myosin heads, little projections sticking off the thick filaments, latch onto the actin filaments. This connection is called a cross bridge.
A bridge between myosin and actin.
Exactly. And then the myosin head sort of pivots or swivels like a tiny ratchet or oar. It pulls the actin filament towards the center of the sarcomere.
Like reeling in a rope.
Kind of, yeah. Or like a molecular tug of war. The myosin heads keep grabbing, pulling, letting go, grabbing further down the actin, pulling again. This action draws the Z-discs closer together, shortening the whole sarcomere.
Okay, here's the mind-bending part I read. The actual filaments, actin, and myosin, they don't get shorter themselves.
That is absolutely correct. It's a crucial point. They stay the same length. The shortening happens because they slide past one another. The zone of overlap between them increases.
Wow, so it's not compression, it's sliding. That's elegant.
It really is. An incredibly efficient way to generate force and movement at a molecular level.
So if they're always ready to grab and pull, what stops our muscles from being constantly tense? How do they relax?
Good point. There are gatekeepers. Covering the actin filaments, specifically blocking the spots where myosin wants to bind, are two inhibitory proteins, troponin and tropomyosin.
Troponin and tropomyosin, the blockers.
Exactly. When the muscle is relaxed, tropomyosin lies over the myosin binding sites on actin, physically blocking them. Troponin kind of holds tropomyosin in place. They're like, nope, no contracting right now.
So they prevent the cross bridges from forming.
Until the right signal arrives, yes.
Okay, so here's where it gets really interesting, right? How does the brain actually give that signal? How does it tell a muscle, okay, contract now?
It all happens at a very specialized synapse, a connection point called the neuromuscular junction, or NMJ for short.
Neuromuscular junction, nerve meets muscle.
Exactly. It's where a motor neuron, a nerve cell coming from your spinal cord or brain, communicates with a muscle fiber. Every single skeletal muscle fiber needs its own nerve connection to tell it when to contract.
One nerve ending per fiber. Or can one nerve talk to multiple fibers?
One nerve cell can branch and talk to multiple fibers. That's called a motor unit. But each fiber typically only has one NMJ, one spot where a nerve ending talks to it. And there's actually a tiny gap there.
Right. The synapse isn't a direct physical connection.
Correct. There's a microscopic space called the synaptic cleft between the end of the nerve and the muscle fiber's membrane, the sarcolemma.
So what crosses that gap? How does the message jump?
When the electrical nerve impulse travels down the motor neuron and reaches the very end, it triggers the release of a chemical messenger, a neurotransmitter.
Okay.
In skeletal muscle, that neurotransmitter is acetylcholine, usually abbreviated as A.
Acetylcholine. A's.
The nerve terminal releases HE into the synaptic cleft through a process called exocytosis. Little packets of HE merge with the nerve ending membrane and dump their contents out.
Okay, let's unpack this. HE is now in the gap. What happens when the muscle fiber hears this chemical message?
The HE molecules drift across that tiny synaptic cleft very quickly and bind to specific receptors on the muscle fiber's sarcolemma, like a key fitting into a lock.
And that binding does what? Opens a door?
Pretty much. It causes channels in the sarcolemma to open, specifically channels that let positive ions, mostly sodium, rush into the muscle cell. This influx of positive charge creates an electrical impulse, an action potential, on the muscle fiber membrane itself.
So the chemical signal gets converted back into an electrical signal, but now on muscle side.
Exactly. And this electrical impulse doesn't just stay on the surface. It travels rapidly along the sarcolemma and then dives deep into the muscle fiber through these specialized tunnels called T-tubules.
T-tubules, like little pipelines into the cell.
Perfect analogy. They carry the electrical signal deep inside, close to where the real magic needs to happen.
And where do those T-tubules lead? What do they signal?
They run right alongside parts of another internal membrane network called the sarcoplasmic reticulum, or SR. Think of the SR as a specialized storage tank within the muscle cell.
Storing what?
Storing calcium ions. Loads of them. When that electrical impulse travels down the T-tubules, it triggers the SR to open its gates and release a flood of calcium ions into the sarcoplasm, right where the actin and myosin filaments are.
Ah, calcium. That sounds like the trigger we needed earlier.
It is the trigger. Calcium is the key that unlocks contraction.
Okay, so how does the muscle then relax? The signal has to stop eventually.
Right. Two main things happen. First, the nerve stops sending impulses, so no more AC is released. Second, any ACD that's still lingering in the synaptic cleft is very quickly broken down by an enzyme called cholinesterase.
Cholinesterase cleans up the AC.
Exactly. It stops the signal at the junction. Simultaneously, inside the muscle fiber, special pumps in the SR membrane start working really hard, actively pumping those calcium ions back into the SR out of the sarcoplasm.
So it's like vacuuming the calcium back up.
That's a great way to put it. As the calcium levels in the sarcoplasm drop, calcium detaches from troponin.
And when calcium leaves troponin?
Troponin changes shape, allowing tropomyosin to slide back over and cover those myosin binding sites on the actin filaments again.
The blockers are back in place.
The blockers are back. Myosin can no longer form cross bridges. The sliding stops, and the muscle fiber passively lengthens back to its resting state. Relaxation.
Okay, let me try and stitch that together. Nerve signal releases HE. HE binds to muscle, creates electrical impulse. Impulse goes down, T-tubules, tells SR to release calcium.
Yeah.
Calcium floods out, binds to troponin. Troponin moves tropomyosin out of the way.
Right.
Myosin heads can now grab actin, form cross bridges, and pull the sliding filament action.
You got it perfectly. That's the sequence.
And then to relax. Nerve stops, HEH is cleared, calcium gets pumped back into the SR, tropomyosin blocks actin again, and the pulling stops.
That's the whole cycle of contraction and relaxation at the molecular level.
Wow. Okay, that raises a fascinating question then.
Mm-hmm.
If each sarcomere, and thus each fiber that's activated, contracts on this all-or-nothing principle, it either contracts fully or not at all when stimulated.
Mm.
How do we manage graded responses? How can I lift a feather really gently, but then lift a heavy dumbbell with much more force? It can't be all or nothing at the whole muscle level.
That is a really insightful question. And the answer lies not in changing how much each individual fiber contracts, because as you said, that's all or nothing. The key is recruitment.
Recruitment, like calling in reinforcements.
Exactly like that. Your nervous system controls the number of muscle fibers that get activated for a particular task. To lift that feather, your brain sends signals down only a few motor neurons, activating just a small number of muscle fibers.
Okay, just a few motor units are turned on.
Precisely. But to lift that heavy dumbbell, your brain sends signals down many, many more motor neurons, recruiting or activating a much larger population of muscle fibers within that same muscle.
So more fibers pulling means more overall force.
Exactly. It's about how many engines you turn on, not how hard each engine runs. Each engine runs at full throttle or not at all, but you can choose to use one engine, 10 engines, or 1,000 engines.
That makes so much sense. It's neural control managing the number of active units.
It's a beautiful system for generating precisely the amount of force needed for any given task.
Okay, so we understand how a muscle contracts microscopically and how the nervous system grades the force. How does this translate into the actual movements we see? Let's talk about the parts of a whole muscle and its action.
Right, so zooming back out to the whole muscle. Every skeletal muscle generally spans at least one joint and has two main attachment points. We call these the origin and the insertion.
Origin and insertion.
The origin is typically the attachment point that's considered more stationary or closer to the body's midline or on the bone that moves less during the contraction. Think of it as the anchor point.
Okay, the stable end.
Usually, yeah. The insertion is the attachment point on the bone that does move when the muscle contracts. It's typically further from the midline or on the more distal bone.
So the muscle pulls the insertion towards the origin.
That's exactly right. And the fleshy, thickest part of the muscle in between those two points is called the belly.
Origin, insertion, belly. Got it. And the action is just what happens when it contracts.
Yes. The action of a muscle is simply the movement it produces at a joint when it shortens, when it pulls that insertion toward the origin. For example, the biceps brachii muscle in your upper arm.
Yeah.
Its origins are up on your shoulder blade.
Okay.
And its insertion is down on one of your forearm bones, the radius.
Right.
So when the biceps contracts, it pulls the forearm up towards the shoulder. The action is flexing the elbow.
Bending the elbow makes sense. And it only pulls.
Can't stress that enough. Only right. pulls. So this means muscles have to work together, or sometimes against each other, to create controlled movement.
Ah, right. If the biceps bends the elbow, something else must straighten it.
Exactly. This brings us to muscle relationships. For any given movement, we have different roles.
Okay, like what?
There's the prime mover, also called the agonist or sometimes protagonist. This is the main muscle responsible for producing a specific movement.
So for bending the elbow, the biceps is the prime mover.
Correct. Then there's the antagonist. This is the muscle that performs the opposite action. It has to relax and lengthen to allow the prime mover's action to occur.
So for elbow flexion, the muscle on the back of the arm, the triceps, would be the antagonist.
Perfect example. The triceps extends the elbow, so it opposes the biceps flexion.
Okay, prime mover and antagonist. Are there others?
Yes, there are also synergists. These are muscles that help the prime mover. They might add extra force, stabilize the joint so the movement is clean, or prevent unwanted movements.
So helpers.
Basically, yeah. For elbow flexion, muscles like the brachialis, which lies underneath the biceps, and the brachioradialis, runs along the forearm, act as synergists, assisting the biceps.
Prime mover, antagonist, synergist. But you said these roles aren't fixed, right?
Absolutely crucial point. These terms are entirely relative to the specific action being discussed.
How so?
Well, let's slip the movement. What if we want to extend the elbow, straighten the arm? Now, the triceps is doing the main work.
So the triceps becomes the prime mover for extension.
Exactly. And the biceps, which flexes the elbow, now has to relax and lengthen. So it becomes the antagonist for elbow extension.
I see. The roles reverse depending on the movement you're analyzing.
Precisely. Understanding this relativity is key to appreciating how muscles coordinate complex movements. It's a constant dance between contraction and relaxation, agonists and antagonists.
That's a really helpful way to think about it. Okay, besides movement, we mentioned another key function earlier, thermogenesis, making heat. Why does exercise warm us up so much?
Well, the biggest reason by far comes down to the chemical reactions involved in muscle activity, especially the process of making and using ATP.
ATP, the energy currency.
Right. Breaking the chemical bonds in molecules like glucose to create ATP, and then breaking ATP bonds to fuel the myosin heads for contraction, these processes aren't 100% efficient.
Energy is lost.
Not lost, but converted. A significant portion of the energy released from these chemical reactions isn't captured as mechanical work, movement. It's released as heat. So the more your muscles work, the more ATP they use, the more chemical reactions occur, and the more heat is generated as a byproduct.
So it's basically metabolic inefficiency keeping us warm.
In a way, yes. And it's vital for maintaining our core body temperature. There's also a smaller contribution from friction.
Friction inside the muscles.
Yeah, think about those actin and myosin filaments sliding past each other millions of times. Mm. Just like rubbing your hands together creates heat, there's microscopic friction within the contracting muscle fibers that generates some heat too.
So chemical reactions are the main furnace. Friction adds a little extra warmth.
That's a good summary. And it explains why shivering, which is rapid, involuntary muscle contraction, is an effective way to warm up when you're cold. Your body is deliberately increasing muscle activity to boost heat production.
Clever. Okay, let's shift gears slightly. Understanding all these muscles can seem overwhelming, partly because of the names. Let's talk muscle nomenclature. How do muscles get these often complicated names?
It might seem daunting, but what's fascinating here is that the names are usually very descriptive. They're not random. They often tell you something important about the muscle.
Like clues hidden in the name.
Exactly. Muscles are often named based on several characteristics, like size. You see maximus for largest, minimus for smallest, major for large, minor for small, longest for long, brevis for short.
Gluteus maximus is the obvious example there.
Perfect one. Then there's shape. Deltoid means triangular, like the Greek letter delta. Rhomboid is diamond-shaped. Serratus looks sawtoothed. Trapezius is trapezoid-shaped.
So the deltoid on the shoulder is named for its shape. Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Location is another big one. Pectoralis refers to the chest, pectoral region. Brachii refers to the upper arm. Femoris relates to the femur, thigh bone. Sterno for sternum, clito for clavicle. Mastoid for the mastoid process on the skull. Digiti refers to fingers or toes.
So sternocleidomastoid tells you its attachments. Sternum, clavicle, mastoid process.
Exactly. It's a map and a name. Another clue is the number of origins or heads. Biceps means two heads. Triceps means three heads. Quadriceps means four heads.
Like biceps brachii, two heads in the arm.
You got it. The direction of the muscle fibers relative to the body's midline is also used. Rectus means straight, like rectus abdominis running straight up your abdomen. Transversus means running across or sideways. Oblique means running diagonally.
Okay, rectus abdominis, straight abdominal muscle, the six-pack.
That's the one. And finally, the muscle's primary action is often part of its name. Adductor muscles bring a limb towards the body midline, they add it. Abductor muscles move a limb away, they abduct it. Flexor muscles cause flexion, bending. Extensor muscles cause extension, straightening. Levator muscles elevate something.
So adductor longus tells you it's a long muscle that adducts the leg.
Precisely. So if you break down the name, you can often figure out a lot about the muscle's location, shape, size, or function before you even see it.
That's actually really helpful. It makes anatomy seem less like pure memorization.
It provides a logical framework, definitely.
Okay, armed with that, let's take a quick tour, maybe highlight some key muscles or groups, applying what we've learned.
Sounds good. Let's start at the top, maybe head and neck.
Sure.
You have the frontalis on your forehead, raises your eyebrows, makes you look surprised. The orbicularis oculi is a circular muscle around your eye. Orbicularis means circular, oculi means eye. Lets you squint or close your eyes tightly.
And one around the mouth, too.
Yep. Orbicularis oris. Oris means mouth. Your kissing muscle lets you pucker your lips. For chewing, the masseter on the side of your jaw and the temporalis on the side of your head are key. They both elevate your mandible, letting you bite down hard.
And we mentioned the sternocleidomastoid SCM, earlier named for its attachments, running diagonally across the neck. Big player in turning and tilting your head.
Huge player. Moving down to the abdominal wall, you have the rectus abdominis running straight up, flexing your trunk, crucial for sit-ups.
The six-pack muscle.
If it's well-developed, yes. Layered underneath and to the sides are the external oblique, internal oblique, and the deepest, the transversus abdominis. Their names tell you the direction their fibers run diagonally and horizontally. They're vital for core stability, twisting and compressing the abdomen.
And that white line down the middle.
The linea alba. That's not actually muscle, but a line of connective tissue where the abdominal muscles meet in the center. Linea alba means white line.
Got it. Okay, shoulder and back.
Big ones here. The deltoid, named for its triangular shape, caps the shoulder. Its main job we see is abducting the arm, lifting it out to the side, like flapping your arms.
Flab like a bird.
Huh, yeah. The pectoralis major is your large chest muscle. It adducts and medially rotates the arm, brings it across your body, like in a chest fly exercise. In the upper back, the large kite-shaped trapezius is complex. Different parts can elevate your shoulders, shrugging, depress them, or pull your shoulder blades back.
Versal muscle. Upper limbs, biceps, and triceps seem key.
Definitely the most famous pair. Biceps brachii on the front of the upper arm, prime mover for elbow flexion. Triceps brachii on the back, prime mover for elbow extension. Remember, they're antagonists to each other.
Right, depending on the movement. What about the forearms? Lots of muscles there.
Loads. Generally, the muscles on the anterior front and medial pinky side of the forearm are flexors of the wrist and fingers. They originate near the medial epicondyle of the humerus. Inflammation there is golfer's elbow.
Ah, okay. Medial side, flexors, golfer's elbow.
And the muscles on the posterior, back, and lateral thumb side are mostly extensors of the wrist and fingers. They originate near the lateral epicondyle. Inflammation there is tennis elbow.
Lateral side, extensors, tennis elbow. That's a useful distinction. Lower body.
Let's see. The sartorius is interesting. It's the longest muscle in the body running diagonally across the thigh, called the tailor's muscle, because it helps you cross your legs like old-time tailors used to sit. It crosses both the hip and knee joints.
Longest muscle. Wow. Inner thigh.
That's your adductor group, commonly called the groin muscles. They do what the name says, adduct the thigh, bring it towards the midline. A groin pull is usually a strain or tear in one of these adductor muscles.
Okay. Front of the thigh. The big one.
The quadriceps femoris, the quads. Named because it has four heads. Rectus femoris, vastus lateralis, vastus intermedius, and vastus medialis. Their main combined action is knee extension, straightening your leg at the knee.
Yeah.
Powerful group.
And the back of the side?
The hamstrings. Actually, a group of three muscles. Biceps femoris, semitendinosus, and semimembranosus. They are the antagonists to the quads. Their primary action is knee flexion, bending the knee.
Hmm.
Also important hip extensors.
Quads extend the knee, hamstrings flex it. Makes sense. What about the buttocks?
The gluteal group, or glutes. Three main ones. Gluteus maximus is the largest, forms most of the buttock shape, and is a powerful hip extensor. Feet climbing stairs or standing up from a squat. Gluteus medius lies partly underneath beside it, and it's the main hip abductor moves your leg out to the side, also key for pelvic stability when walking. And the smaller gluteus minimus assists the medius.
Maximus for power extension, medius for side movement and stability. Got it. And finally, the lower leg, the calf.
Your main calf muscles are the gastrocnemius, the prominent two-headed muscle you see, and the soleus underneath it. There's also a small, often insignificant muscle called plantaris that's missing in about maybe 25% of people.
Gastroc and soleus are the big ones then.
Yes. And all three converge to form the thick Achilles tendon, or calcaneal tendon, which attaches to your heel bone. Their main action is plantar flexion, pointing your foot downwards, like standing on your tiptoes.
And the front of the shin, what pulls your foot up?
That's primarily the tibialis anterior. Runs down the front of your tibia, shin bone. Its main action is dorsiflexion, lifting your foot upwards towards your shin. Runners often feel this muscle working hard, sometimes leading to shin splints if overused.
Tibialis anterior pulls foot up, calf muscles point foot down, another antagonist pair.
Exactly.
Phew, that was quite the tour, but connecting the names and functions really helps. We've covered a huge amount, from the whole body movements right down to those tiny proteins sliding past each other.
Yeah, it's a lot to take in.
So what does this all mean? I guess it just highlights the incredible, almost unbelievable engineering packed inside us.
It really does. This deep dive, I hope, shows not just the complexity, but the sheer elegance of the muscular system. Every single movement, every shiver, every beat of your heart, though we didn't focus on cardiac muscle, it's all driven by these principles.
A finely tuned symphony, as you said earlier.
Absolutely. Cells, signals, structures, all working together. It's a testament to biological organization and specialization.
Well, hopefully everyone listening now feels they have a shortcut to being genuinely well-informed about their own amazing muscles. Maybe some surprising facts to share, and definitely a new appreciation for what your body does without you even thinking about it.
And maybe think about this as you go about your day. Now that you have a better sense of origins, insertions, agonists, antagonists, how might that understanding change how you approach something practical, like stretching a specific muscle more effectively, or thinking about your posture, or how you lift things?
Applying the knowledge.
Exactly. The more we grasp our internal mechanics, the better we can potentially care for, and maybe even optimize, our body's incredible capacity for movement and function. Something to consider?